supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. For nearly 20 years, Philadelphia Democratic Party Chair Bob Brady has served in Congress without ever facing a serious challenge for re-election. That could change next year. An FBI investigation into Brady's 2012 re-election campaign, as well as changing demographics in his district, have encouraged several challengers to consider a run at Brady's seat in next year's Democratic primary. WHYY's Dave Davies offers this look at whether the old-school politician is vulnerable in 2018.
You wouldn't mistake Bob Brady for a graduate of the Kennedy School of Government. He's schooled in street-level politics, rising through the ranks of the 34th Ward in Overbrook to become party chairman. Here's part of a discourse he gave a visitor in his ward headquarters on Election Day 2016, explaining that basic constituent service is the key to success in politics.
You know, presidents are great and mayors are great. People like to say that they voted for them, but they still want their potholes fixed. They still want a stop sign. They still want a street light. You know, and that's the bread and butter.
Now 72, Brady's built strong relationships throughout his district, which includes parts of South Philadelphia, Center City, and the river wards of the Northeast. It also includes riverfront communities in Delaware County. Former city controller Jonathan Seidel, an old Brady ally, says he's heard of potential challenges, but wouldn't bet against Brady.
I can't find anybody that's against him. I can't find any union that's against him. I can't find any community group that he hasn't touched in the last 20 years. You helped a lot of people, and he hasn't had any opposition because of that.
But there are signs the political terrain is shifting. The river wards and South Philadelphia communities that were historically white working-class neighborhoods loyal to the party organization are increasingly home to new, more independent and progressive voters. Many are energized by the election of Donald Trump, and they turned out in big numbers in the May Democratic primary, shocking the Democratic establishment by dumping three-term incumbent city controller Alan Butkovitz in favor of first-time candidate Rebecca Reinhardt. Democratic strategist Brendan McPhillips says they're not the same electorate Brady's used to running in.
They're younger voters. They're not looking to their committee person and their ward leader as much to get their guidance on who to support. They're figuring that out for themselves. And if there's somebody who excites them, that's who they're going to get behind.
There's another reason Brady could be facing some headwinds next year.
Tonight, one of Philadelphia's most powerful lawmakers is under scrutiny. Court documents show the FBI searched the emails of Pennsylvania Congressman Bob Brady.
For months, federal authorities have investigated what they say was a deal Brady struck in 2012 to get a primary opponent out of the race by funneling $90,000 from Brady's campaign fund to pay off the opponent's debts. Brady hasn't been charged, but two of his longtime associates have. These political consultants have been charged with engaging in phony transactions to hide the payments. One has pled guilty. The other may go to trial during next year's campaign, generating more damaging media coverage. It's not hard to imagine an opponent's line of attack. Brady's old-school deal-making has brought shame to the city, and it's time for a younger, more progressive representative in Washington. Nina Ahmed, a former president of the Philadelphia chapter of the National Organization for Women, is already in the race. She says it has nothing to do with the investigation.
I was going to do this regardless of whether he was vulnerable or not. Because for us to be in the 21st century and to have no women representing Pennsylvania is reprehensible.
At least two more candidates say they're considering jumping in. A large field could actually help Brady by splitting the opposition vote. Brady declined to discuss his re-election prospects, except to say he's confident going before voters again. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
During this week, marking the passing of the notorious Cardinal Bernard Law, a new investigation points to the ability of New Jersey teachers accused of sexual misconduct to keep getting jobs at other schools. Joining me in discussion are NJ.com reporters Adam Clark and Jessica Remo. Adam, Jessica, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
This study does invoke what is already known about scandals in the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts, and the commonality is the practice you refer to as passing the trash. Explain.
So passing the trash really is when a school district receives a complaint about a teacher and they decide this is someone who we don't want in our school. But rather than pursuing firing them or trying to get their license taken away, they allow that teacher to resign and the teacher goes somewhere else where fellow teachers, parents, students, administrators are unaware of the complaints against them in their previous school.
And Jessica, the report cites several examples. First up is one Jason Fennis. Describe his situation.
Yeah, I think Jason Fennis really is the person we think of when we think of Pass the Trash in New Jersey, because it's a case where there was definitely a pattern of the district allegedly knowing that he had behaved inappropriately with students. And it took really 5 years before they took action. And when he left that district, there was a separation agreement, which we were able to read, that said, when another district asks about you, we're just going to tell them, you know, your dates of employment and very basic information and nothing further. And so he was able to get a job just a few minutes away in another district in another county where he repeated that behavior.
Adam, this isn't exclusively, though, an indictment on this district. It's happened at other districts as well.
Right. And that's what we've seen across the state and also from outside of the state. Two of the teachers in our story came from New York City public schools. They were accused of sexual contact with students there. The district investigated. In one case, they had surveillance video of that teacher going up the stairs of a hotel with a student. But yet they were able to leave and within a year come to New Jersey schools and start working there. Those schools said we didn't know anything about it until these allegations were revealed later.
On the face of it, why doesn't New Jersey have safeguards in place to protect those who are vulnerable?
So to some extent, they do. When a teacher is charged criminally with something, that obviously gets reported right away. What districts would consider a fine line between what is inappropriate behavior that you shouldn't be teaching versus behavior that gets reported to police. And so in the absence of a criminal conviction, districts often feel like we don't know that we can get rid of this teacher. We don't know that we can fire them. We don't know that they'll lose tenure. It's a complicated and lengthy and sometimes expensive process. So it's much easier to allow a teacher to resign. You have them out of your school. The problem is solved on your end, at least.
Any sense of how Governor-elect Murphy falls on this issue?
Actually, we do have some sense on how he feels about it because one of our reporters was able to ask him at a press conference. He said he read our story and vomited, having read the things that were written in our story, and that he would support smart legislation that could help stop this, though he hadn't read the bill itself.
It's amazing in this context that New Jersey seems to be in the preponderance of states that don't enjoy these protections. Pennsylvania does to a greater degree.
Right. Pennsylvania 3 years ago passed a similar bill, a Passing the Trash bill that passed unanimously. New Jersey, this bill was introduced in January. It hasn't gone anywhere yet, but we do know that Teresa Ruiz, the chair of the Senate Education Committee, she says she's going to post this bill in the new legislative session in January and that they have to do everything they can to protect children.
Jessica, is there any question that such a bill would enjoy bipartisan support?
It should be a no-brainer, right? We're protecting children from predators. And so I think that, you know, there are concerns that there's due process for any teachers that are accused. You want to make sure that false allegations are, you know, weeded out. And so I think that that is what the legislation really needs to have the T's crossed and I's dotted on that. But the basic premise, you would think, would be a no-brainer.
It's a very extensive report. We'll have a link to it on our website, whyy.org-news. Thank you so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
NJ.com reporters Adam Clark and Jessica Remo. Millions of Americans live with a condition where their hands shake uncontrollably while trying to accomplish simple tasks like writing or eating. To help them, Pennsylvania Hospital is slowly rolling out a new non-invasive neurosurgery technique to stop these tremors deep within the brain. For WHYY's Health Desk, Kyrie Greenberg reports.
James Neihardt lost his right arm in combat during the Vietnam War. And 15 years ago, he started noticing a tremor in his left hand that gradually got worse.
I can't write any longer. I can't sign my name. It is very annoying because it limits everything you do.
Neihardt's diagnosis is called essential tremor. Aside from a shaky hand, he's medically healthy. And after trying every medication for his condition with no luck, the only other option was deep brain stimulation, a procedure that inserts a wire into the brain attached to a pacemaker that suppresses the tremor. His wife, Judy, didn't like the sound of it.
And we chose, not to do that yet because we're too many. This can happen, that can happen.
Instead, he signed up for a new, non-invasive procedure that uses a beam of ultrasound waves to injure the thalamus, a tiny part of the inner brain that controls some involuntary movements. Approved by the FDA last year, Neihardt is Pennsylvania Hospital's seventh patient to undergo the procedure. First, Dr. Gordon Baltuck does a series of CT and MRI scans to make sure he's hitting the right spot.
So here there's a lot of calibration that gets done. And we shot where we thought was the center, but we were just like a very little bit off to the right. Then it was like we took our eyepiece and we shift our eyepiece just a little bit.
As Baltuck dials in on his target, he intensifies the strength of his ultrasound scalpel, all while making sure the beam isn't too hot.
One person's brain is not like the other. If you want to see it in a very simplistic fashion, if you put a heating coil within an egg, some eggs are going to become boiled at much different temperatures and in a different way depending on your egg. So if you just go in and you just do one temperature, some will be undercooked, some will be overcooked.
To help prevent overheating, Neihardt wears a rubbery hat filled with cold water in a 60-degree room. He's awake the whole time, and after each zap of ultrasound, nurses check his tremor by having him draw a spiral on a sheet of paper. Even with the smaller doses, his hand becomes noticeably steadier.
There we go, a big sonication.
The final zap makes Neihardt feel really dizzy, but less than 5 minutes later, he can draw a nearly perfect spiral, something he hasn't done in years. The FDA study showed that overall, patients see a 40% improvement in their symptoms after a year. Some people, though, reported recurring numbness in their fingers, headaches, and trouble balancing after the procedure. As he's wheeled to the recovery room, Neihardt waves, and nurse practitioner Hanan Shebanu holds his drawing like a masterpiece.
Like every time I start getting like all emotional, it's just, can you believe? I mean, how he was like just 2 hours ago is just unbelievable. And now, yeah, like, yay!
For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
Last night, a group of volunteers brought a Christmas celebration to those who are homeless and living in addiction in Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood. As Joel Wolfram reports for WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, they visited one of the new tent cities that residents say have sprung up since the city closed off the Conrail tracks to homeless heroin users.
The volunteers start out their mobile Christmas party on a street corner a block away from the old encampment at the Conrail tracks. They offer warm beverages to small groups of people who emerge from the dark streets and lyric sheets to anyone who wants to sing along. Some who show up are mainly interested in the bags of donated clothing. Asteria Vivas, who works to help drug users get off the streets with her organization Home Quarters and Friends, has been coordinating the celebration here for the past couple of years.
The outsiders, the ones that consider themselves outsiders, you're not outsiders, we're here for you.
This year, Vivas and her group are making an extra stop. Now that the nearby encampment has been cleared out, neighborhood residents like Dennis Payne say that crowds of homeless drug users are taking refuge elsewhere.
When you look under the bridge at Kensington and Lehigh, Emerald and Lehigh, they're just two small pop-up, you know, little tent cities, you know, and there's a lot more in the side streets and the alleys. I mean, we now kind of like magnified the problem.
The tent city under the Emerald Street Bridge, about a five-minute drive away, is where the volunteers head next. The sidewalk is jammed end-to-end with mattresses and makeshift tents for dozens of people taking shelter. Cynthia Rivera is one of them. She says she's been spending a lot of time here since becoming homeless in September.
I didn't think I was even going to sing. Look at the situation. You only knew my situation. A person wouldn't be singing in my situation, but because of them, you know, like I forgot for a couple of minutes about my what I'm going through, you know.
The city recently announced that more help is on the way for people who are homeless and addicted to drugs in Kensington. It's sending a new mobile outreach van to places like Emerald Street to help get people into treatment, and is working to find a site for a new shelter to open 30 more beds. For WHYY News, Joel Wolfram.
Heading south over the holidays? Doubtful you'll be going as far south as Rutgers University seniors Taylor Dodge and Stephen Weber. They join me now to share their itinerary and intent. Taylor, Steve, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Taylor, you and Steve are students in the Rutgers School of Environmental and Biological Sciences, and this is very much a work vacation, if we'll call it that. Where are you going?
Antarctica.
What are you doing?
Studying krill and climate change.
And what's the relationship between krill and climate change?
So basically, as you have a warming climate, you're going to be getting a shift in the range of the species. So the krill serves as a food source for both penguins as well as various whale species that come down to the Antarctic. And as the temperatures change, you're going to be getting more of a poleward shift of that distribution, and that affects the populations of penguins and the whales because they have to change their foraging patterns. And that, in turn, affects how much energy they have to expend and reduces the amount of energy they can use to both create new offspring as well as grow.
Give listeners a sense of Antarctica this time of year. Terrain, temperature?
Temperatures are... Right now it's summer down there, so your temperatures aren't much too far off from a really cold winter in New Jersey.
Max is at about 10 degrees, but I think it's around 0 degrees.
Typically.
Right now, yeah.
Much colder than that at night?
Probably, yeah. I know it's mostly sunlight down there now because it's the summertime for the most part. I know they took one of the grad students down there. They posted a picture of it around 2 a.m. and it looked just like a sunset at 2 a.m.
Like twilight or sunrise. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That might take some getting used to, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Let's talk more about collecting that data. Describe this research vessel you'll be on. How many people will be doing it with you? Is it an 8-hour day and then you're free and go to the movies or hang out?
Like for the ship, it's a large research vessel and you kind of work in shifts. Like you'll have a group of people who work an 8-hour shift or so, and then they'll go and eat and they'll go into bed and do everything else, and then they'll just rotate throughout the day. I think there's 3 different shift times. So I think that's how they do it. And I think there's about 40 people on the ship, or is around that?
I believe it's around 40 people, probably about 20 to 25 scientists and then crew members.
And then crew members above and beyond that. Mm. What do you do during off time? First on the ship and then off?
I think they have TV rooms. You can watch TV. You bring books, bring lots of books. And they have a gym there too. So it's like limited, but they have things for you to do.
Was this season chosen in part to reduce the chances of getting ice locked?
That is part of it. It's also a lot more hospitable. There's what's called wintering over in Antarctica.
What does that refer to?
That's if you stay during the winter season, or what their winter season would be, which is the summer season in the Northern Hemisphere. And during that time, temperatures can get as low as negative 100 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. And you have to have a lot more medical vetting in order to do that, because you're not getting... There's not as much resupply action, so you're not getting a lot of contact from the outside world. So you have to go into more like mental testing. You have to be, you know, really mentally stable, be able to be kind of separated from the world for a long time.
Will it be so isolating that you'll only be able to contact family and friends intermittently while you're down there?
The boat, you have email access. You go through their server, and they also have a phone. I don't know how often you can use it. I'm assuming not often.
Steve, you're there for 6 weeks and then coming back and completing your semester studies. Taylor, you'll be there the full 12-week.
Yeah.
So in some sense of real time, can others follow along with the progress of the trip? Will you be posting in some sense?
I have a friend making me a blog so I can post as I go along. And I'm going to send him what I'm going to write, and he can update it while I'm on the ship if I can't access it.
And Steve, how about for you?
Mostly mine's just going to be email contact, as well as there's actually a website called marinetraffic.com, and using that you can actually look up the name of the ship. It's the Lawrence M. Gould, and you'll be able to see the progress of the ship as it moves. So, because it has a APHIS tracker on it, and it basically will ping its location every few minutes, and it'll show on the website where the ship
navigational progress.
Yes.
That's really cool. Taylor, do you have a sibling or parents or a relative that infused you with this love of either specifically marine biology or ecology or biology or science?
I actually had a teacher in high school. It was an ecology class we took, and she'd always take us on field trips. And it's like, I talk to students now, they never had that chance in high school, but she taught us how to do field sampling, and it was just that exposure.
Steve, how did you first get the bug, as it were?
Taylor and I actually started out in the same class. They gave a lecture on Antarctica and the research that was going on down there, and I basically fell in love with it. It's an amazing opportunity. I just was really happy that I was granted the opportunity to take advantage of it.
Did any family and friends have any souvenirs they want you to bring back, like a little ice cube from the Antarctica?
Everyone wants a penguin.
Everybody wants a penguin?
Everybody
wants a penguin.
Well, no, I'm going to hold these penguins back.
Taylor Dodge, Steve Weber, safe traveling. We'll be interested to hear from you when you come back. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rutgers University seniors Taylor Dodge and Steve Weber. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Republicans passed a long-awaited tax overhaul this week. To get a sense of how it's playing with the public, we'll hear from Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, on tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.